This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Welcome back to our weekly series on inequality in the Baltimore region, The Lines Between Us. In this series, we've looked at economic challenges, housing, and criminal justice. Now we want to look at issues of inequality in education. And we're starting with Brown v. Board of Education, the landmark ruling on school segregation. In May 1954, the Supreme Court wrote in its decision, quote, "Segregation is a denial of the equal protection of the laws," close quote. We want to know how Brown played out in Baltimore and what the legacy is today of the way the school board implemented desegregation. In a few minutes, we'll talk with Ray Winbush, director of Morgan State University's Institute for Urban Research, and Howell Baum, author of Brown in Baltimore, School Desegregation and the Limits of Liberalism. First, the stories of three people who were attending Baltimore City Public Schools when the decision came down.
My name is Kiefer Jackson Mitchell, Senior. And I integrated Winds Falls Junior High School. And I was beaten up by a group of neighborhood toughs because of my presence in the neighborhood. And the neighbors resented my presence. My father had to walk a one-man picket line in front of the school with a sign, "I am an American too." Little did I realize that the same intolerance has not gone away. 2 weeks ago, my 16-year-old grandson was playing basketball in the neighborhood where I live, Guilford. And intolerant neighbors called anonymously 911 to report him as an adult black male playing basketball in the backyard, because very few African Americans live in this neighborhood.
I'm Carolyn Holland Cole. I just retired from the Baltimore City Public School System. I was a student at a very small school on Denmore Avenue that housed three grades in one classroom. There were only two rooms. And as a child, over the summer, I would always be on the playground at Arlington Elementary looking in the windows and wondering what it was like to go to a school of this caliber. When Baltimore City received notice that the schools were now going to be integrated, my parents made a decision that I was going to go that September. And as a nine-year-old, the only vision you had were things that you had seen on TV, with students being attacked by dogs and water hose. I remember the walkway, and I walked through the middle of all these people with my mom, still very nervous. But from that day on, I never had a problem. I was received warmly by the teachers, by the principal, the students.
My name is Brent Cooper. I live in Bel Air, Maryland. I am Caucasian. In September 1954, I entered the Baltimore Polytechnic Institute. My homeroom class was about 30 students and included two African-American lads. A few days after the fall semester began, a rabble-rouser called for a citywide school strike to protest the integration of our schools. At Poly, the strike didn't work. We went to class. Dr. Wilmer DeHoff, the visionary principal of that place, called a school-wide assembly in which he told us that our attendance for that day was normal and the strike had no effect, and he was proud of us, quote, "real Poly boys," unquote. Integration at Poly was solely with that incident. So it's not much of a story except to contrast it with that of my wife. My wife entered Clifton Park Junior High School. She would have been in eighth grade, and it was ugly. The sidewalk in front of the school was full of people carrying signs and yelling words like "N-lover," and they went to their classes and did their thing. Yet, she said, all day long, you could hear these shouts. The crowd apparently stayed around for a while, and it was very scary for her.
Producers Lawrence Lanahan and Jamila Kay brought us those stories from Kiefer Mitchell Sr., Carolyn Cole, and Brent Cooper. They were all students in Baltimore City Public Schools when the Brown v. Board decision came down in 1954. With me now in the studio is Ray Winbush, director of Morgan State University's Institute for Urban Research. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Sheila.
And also here is Howell Baum, author of Brown in Baltimore, School Desegregation and the Limits of Liberalism. He's professor of urban studies and planning at the University of Maryland. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
I want to start by laying out the Baltimore public schools in less than 50 years after the Brown decision. By the year 2000, Baltimore City Public School students had become the most racially isolated in the country, according to a study by the Civil Rights Project at Harvard University. The average black student in 2000 attended a school where just 6% of pupils were white. The average white student went to a school that was almost half white, even though whites made up just over 1/10 of the whole system enrollment. So in other words, most of the white kids clustered in just a few schools. By 2010, the percentage of white students in city schools was down to 8%. Professor Winbush, give us a sense of what that racial isolation does to a child and what benefits integration brings.
Well, the history of caste segregation in the United States is so embedded in, as part of what we are as Americans, and we try to deny it, but it's there. Kenneth Clark, the psychologist, in leading up to Brown v. Board, he and his wife did the famous dolls test, where they show black and white dolls to children, and the black kids, of course, said the black doll was ugly, the white doll was pretty, and so forth. The frightening thing about that is that that study has been replicated just last year, and the same thing is there. So I think that, some people call it rumors of inferiority. The idea that blacks are inferior to whites plays out in schools. And it played out in the desegregation of schools in that we felt, you know, being around black people in terms of education is bad, so we're going to engage in what now is called white flight. And black students felt being around white students was better. And so there's still this idea that blacks are inferior. Blacks oftentimes inculcate that psychologically. And whites say we're superior, and that is inculcated. And it plays out in how schools are segregated or desegregated.
Professor Baum, I get the impression from your book, Brown in Baltimore, that Baltimore schools never integrated that much in the first place.
Baltimore City school officials desegregated in 1954. The Supreme Court said, as you said, separate schools are inherently unequal schools. And the school board of 8 whites and 1 black said, we're so glad we can vote our conscience now, and we want to end 87 years of segregation in Baltimore. But they chose a very strange policy, and the policy was one of free choice, meaning any child could choose to go to any school, and no child would be required to go to any particular school. And the school board assumed that from that point on, no child would be identified as having any race. So any desegregation or integration would be wholly voluntary and dependent on parents' decisions. The government would not intervene in any way. In the first years, almost no whites chose to go to historically black schools. And I think some of the factors which are important to identify are physically the black schools had been victims of poor funding. They were not schools that were worth choosing if one had choice of schools. And also many of the black teachers had received training at Coffin, which had been poorly funded and whose faculty had been poorly trained, and they didn't have all the training they wanted or all the training they should have. And some white families had questions about whether they would want to choose those schools for their children. So there were some realistic reasons for not making those choices.
Let me just establish, though, at that point, the system was predominantly white students.
It was 60% white and 40% black, and all white students went to white schools, and all black students except for 16 black boys who went to Poly went to so-called colored schools. And then the new policy said they're no longer white or black schools, they're just schools. And they said, let's imagine the history means nothing. Let's imagine that people have no racial identities. Go. And what happened, I've talked about the whites not choosing historically black schools. A small but growing number of blacks chose historically white schools. And I think a significant proportion of them were black children from middle class or elite black families whose parents, like Kiefer Mitchell's parents, were confident about the larger city. They knew the larger city and were prepared to send their children to schools in the larger city. Also, the free choice policy didn't pay for transportation. So parents, to take advantage of free choice away from home, would need to be able to afford a private car or bus fare.
So there may have been black families who would have liked to have made that choice and couldn't.
I assume that's the case. And what I'd emphasize here in coming back to the question of why do we have a preponderance of low-income blacks in the school system today is under segregation, you had mixed income, you had economically heterogeneous black schools. And now black middle class chose out, leaving the low-income blacks behind in the historically black schools. So middle class blacks were able to take advantage of the opportunities, and then they created economically as well as racially segregated schools. And the last thing I'll say, and then bring the story to an end, is in 1968, the Federal Fair Housing Act declared that housing discrimination was illegal, making it possible for many middle class blacks who could afford homes to move to the suburbs for the same kinds of reasons that middle-class whites had moved to the suburbs. So it really diminished the middle-class black population.
That's Hal Baum, author of Brown in Baltimore, School Desegregation and the Limits of Liberalism, here on Maryland Morning, The Lines Between Us on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also here is Ray Winbush, director of Morgan State's Institute for Urban Research. When Professor Baum called it the free choice policy a strange policy, you nodded, Professor Winbush. Strange in your view because?
Well, if I'm not mistaken, Professor Baum can correct me, that I think there were four cities in the United States or so that adopted this idea of free choice. In most cities, you know, like Boston was the classic example, much later on, of course, of forced busing and the violence that was associated with that. But, you know, I think it's telling that Baltimore chose in one fell swoop to kind of say, as, you know, my colleague said, we're not going to deal with the racial caste segregation of this country with regard to school. We're simply going to say anybody can go to any school they want. And if I'm not mistaken, I think like 2 or 3% of blacks chose that, you know, for whatever reason. But only a handful, and I mean literally a handful, of whites chose to go to black schools. And again, I think it goes back to this idea of rumors of inferiority. I mean, it was very clear at that time that people in Baltimore knew black schools were inferior. Black folk knew that they were inferior. And I always say that you didn't really in 54 needed to bust bodies, but you needed to bust dollars from white schools who were getting more money into the black community. So Baltimore chose kind of a bizarre way of, quote, integrating. And I use that word very, very loosely because it really didn't happen.
But as I read in your book, Professor Baum, black leaders, the NAACP, supported this free choice policy. Why?
Well, Kiefer Mitchell's mother, Juanita Jackson Mitchell, was active leader of the local NAACP. She was nationally known in the NAACP. She supported this policy. NAACP took credit for the school boards adopting this policy. Blacks in Baltimore supported it for 2 decades. No civil rights group in Baltimore ever sued the school board to do something different. I think in part they were liberals like school board officials who believed in free individual choice. I think they believed also, like school officials did, that a policy like this, which didn't talk about race, it simply said, let's give individuals choices, let's assume children don't have race, and it didn't force anything on whites. I think they assumed a policy like this would make things go more easily. The less said about race, the more likely something could be adopted. Third thing is, the policy worked for families like the Mitchell family. Middle-class blacks could choose good schools for their children. They could afford to get their children there. Their children got good choices. And for those blacks who preferred, for whatever the reasons, to keep their children in all-black schools, they weren't forced to leave those all-black schools. So if they valued them as social and cultural and neighborhood or community centers, they could keep their children there. So the policy had benefits for blacks with different preferences without forcing them to do anything.
The NAACP, you know, I'm giving away a trade secret now, is a fairly middle-class black organization. And they saw the advantage of doing this for themselves. And I mean, that's no indictment of the Mitchell family or other groups, but it is kind of telling about the class differences within the African-American community that sometimes we overlook.
There were a couple of chances during the 60s or 70s, I guess, when the federal government said, hey, you know, the numbers aren't working.
Mm-hmm. Sure. There were, in the 1960s in Baltimore and elsewhere, there was an active civil rights movement, and people started to say, can't we do something more active to integrate the city schools? And Mayor Tommy D'Alessandro defeated Peter Angelos to become elected mayor in 1967, and D'Alessandro wanted to integrate schools and other institutions. And he was set to do this, and then Martin Luther King was killed. And riots followed, and white backlash followed after the riots. And I think both whites and blacks pulled back from interest in integration. I think it was really a watershed event. Then timing is everything. Just following the riots, the Supreme Court came down with a decision which said free choice desegregation plans are constitutionally unacceptable unless they actually desegregate schools. So the question was, what was Baltimore going to do? And Mayor D'Alessandro and the president of the school board and the superintendent all chose to ignore the Supreme Court decision. And William Donald Schaefer, who always said what he thought, was president of the city council at the time and said he didn't want to talk about any new desegregation policy because, quote, then immediately the question of race comes in. Mm-hmm. Meaning he didn't want to talk about race. He felt Baltimoreans didn't want to talk about race, particularly after the pain of the riots. So the city continued on with a policy that was arguably unconstitutional. And then finally we get to the event, which is in 1974, the Federal Office for Civil Rights said to Baltimore, look, unless you do more deliberately to integrate the schools, we will withhold federal education funds. And black superintendent Roland Patterson said, we still like free choice. School officials said, we still like free choice. And they offered a modest plan. The federal government finally said, we're going to move to withhold funds. William Donald Schaefer was now mayor, and he said, we will sue the Office for Civil Rights to get an injunction to prevent them from withholding funds. And to make a long, fascinating story in the court short, the city succeeded. And in 1978, Federal Court of Appeals upheld the district court, which said, no, the Office for Civil Rights can't do anything in Baltimore. And so that's the end of the story.
This is The Lines Between Us on Maryland Morning on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Howell Baum, author of Brown in Baltimore, School Desegregation and the Limits of Liberalism, and with Ray Winbush, director of Morgan State's Institute for Urban Research. Professor Winbush, what do you think our region would look like today if the school board had taken a more active approach to implementing Brown v. Board?
How it would look now, I'm not sure. Probably much like it looks today.
Even if they had been more active? You're saying...
Chuck Willey of Harvard, who wrote a book called Desegregation Plans at Work or something like that, his argument was, you know, the idea of gerrymandering school boundaries and stuff. He said none of that stuff worked.
Well,
and I don't think that's a sign of being jaded, but I think it's a sign of... you know, simply acknowledging that we still have race as an issue in this country, regardless now, you know, next year will be 60 years since Brown. And we still have segregation. We still like to decontextualize the issue of race, which President Obama a couple of weeks ago tried to contextualize in a, you know, short speech.
Well, does it make any sense then for me to ask you what I had hoped to, which is whether you see a path to more integrated schools in Baltimore?
See, for me as a black person, I don't think black people are around town in Baltimore or L.A. or Chicago saying, how can we get our schools more integrated? I think that black people and black parents are saying, how can we get better schools for our children? But they don't necessarily connect that with desegregation or sitting, you know, having more white kids in the school. Black parents always have been strategic in trying to educate their children because of caste segregation in this country. So a path to school desegregation, I mean, I really haven't thought about it for a long time.
It's not your priority.
And most black folk, and I'm not trying to speak for the black middle class, I don't think most black people even talk about that type of stuff.
Professor Baum, is it, in your mind, a priority? And if so, do you see a way to get there? More integrated schools in Baltimore?
I think there's really a question of what it is that schools influence and what it is that's under the influence of other institutions in society. So that we expect the schools to solve not just educational problems, but social problems. And it's not realistic. And educators self-defeatingly say, yeah, sure, we can do everything. And everyone else is content to say, sure, it's on the schools to get these children out of poverty into the middle class. and no one else is responsible for that. So that we assume somehow tinkering within the school system without finding employment for men and women who don't have jobs, for parents who need employment so that they can have provide their children with economic security, psychological authority, security within the home, and models of success that would motivate their children to do well at school because mom and dad, in fact, succeeded and are part of the larger society. The schools can't do that. We need social policy that would provide employment, jobs, that bring money and self-respect to parents. And that would do a great deal to improve the quality of education because children would see reasons to do
exactly.
Well. Teachers would respond well to the children. Parents would have good reasons to encourage their children to do well and so forth. So at heart, I'm in favor of integration, but I think this isn't something that simply tinkering with schools accomplishes.
I think what has happened, you know, is K through 12, many of us have, black parents, I'm not talking about as scientists or whatever, we kind of said that didn't work. What has worked, I think, in terms of exposing black students and white students to multicultural education has been, you know, college and universities. Now, clearly, there's a class issue there because we still have in Baltimore, for example, community colleges that are predominantly black. But in four-year colleges and stuff, I think that's where the multicultural education is taking place. We had hoped, of course, that Brown v. Board children were going to experience the advantages of being in a multicultural situation, access to materials and stuff. It didn't really happen. So I think what Professor Baum said is very important. Black people in general right now, at least the ones I talk to, and I talk to a lot of them, they're talking about jobs, you know, economic security, so that they can send their children to the best schools, wherever it is, K through 12.
Thank you both so much for talking to us about this. Thank you.
Thank you for having this conversation.
Yeah, it's good.
Ray Winbush directs Morgan State University's Institute for Urban Research. Howell Baum, professor of urban studies and planning at the University of Maryland, is the author of Brown in Baltimore, School Desegregation and the Limits of Liberalism. At our website, you can see pictures of people who were students in Baltimore City Public Schools when Brown v. Board was implemented in Baltimore, and you can hear their full stories about experiencing school desegregation in 1954. Go to linesbetweenus.org. On 88.1, I'm Sheila Cast. More after a break. Stay with us on 88.1.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Lines Between Us, WYPR's year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. This is Maryland Morning senior producer Lawrence Lanahan. Now, join the conversation at facebook.com/thelinesbetweenus. Or tell us your story at linesbetweenus.org. The Lines Between Us is made possible by grants from Associated Black Charities, Cohen Opportunity Fund, Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, Baltimore Community Foundation, and Open Society Institute Baltimore, as well as support from members of the WYPR Board of Directors. I hope you'll join us again on Friday at 9 a.m. on 88.1 FM in the Baltimore region, and everywhere else, streaming live at WYPR.org. Have a great day.